chair and committee, House File 1665 has become a real labor of love. One of the best parts of this has been working on it with my co-chair, Representative Frank Farnham. And I was going to ask earlier to co-chair a working group in the education finance area on shared services, and we have had one of the, I think, the best things about it was listening to the stakeholders from across the state who have a strong belief that this is already happening. But what this bill does is it creates a clearinghouse in the state auditor's office that would allow simple access to best practices and procurement and services. Let me move House File 1665, and I think this is
Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Moe, and I'm here representing Southwest Central Service Cooperative. And on behalf of the Executive Director, Cliff Carmody, and his board, staff, and member schools, I'm here to express support for House File 1655. I also want to thank Representative Swales and McFarland. They took a leisurely three-hour drive to Marshall here about a month ago and attended one of the board meetings, and we sincerely appreciated their attendance. We particularly appreciate the approach that they have offered with this legislation, and I sense you want to keep this very short, so let me just quickly say programs that the service cooperative provide. These are, of course, shared services from joint purchasing to education district, telecommunications, and so much more. The Southwest Western Service Cooperative believes that information sharing of best practices that will be provided by this bill will allow the agency to share our best practices as well as allow Southwest Residential Service Department to learn, grow, and better serve our members. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Chair, can I clarify? After it's been to Education Finance, after meeting with the state auditor, she said it would cost the same to do this for school districts as well as all units of government. And so we've expanded it to be for all units of government, cities, counties, townships, and the state. So for the same cost. So I also wanted to share that somebody who was instrumental in helping was Ted Lilly from the State Hall Chamber, who came to me and shared with me the report of over 5 or 6 years of shared services study that they've done. And this is a chart that shows all the shared services that are happening amongst the cities and the county and school districts around the state within Ramsey County. So we know a lot of this is currently happening. And he also brought forward the state auditor's report from 2004 to 2005, the best practices report on cooperative efforts in public service delivery and contracting for services and procurement. And so I just want to let you know that we've really done some homework on this and we think it's a wise investment.
Motion is then that this motion then goes to finance.
She's here and soon to negotiate with the governor. Congressman, others on the bond, appreciate you having us. The amendment, day one amendment, I'll have the chair explain, but this is Madam Chair, members, Madam Chair, the most important part of the amendment is it changes Minnesota management and budget to finance.
Okay,
And then second, the clarifies the
fact we need to move the bill. So we'll move the bill to bring it before. Representative Winkler moves House File 2146.
Madam Chair, changing finance.
I complimented the author on the.
And then second, it clarifies the funds, the revolving loan funds, and makes sure that the Department of Administration retains some authority as well. Just a cleanup amendment.
Madam Chair,
members, we had this discussion here in operations, and it's here because the Finance Committee needs to incorporate this language in order to ensure that sort of management and office. Again, new title, and that would the reception of federal funds. For your indulgence in taking us through.
I'm so complex. All those in place. Right. We're going to pass it. Oh, no. Sorry. Okay. Oh, Representative Rubin.
Pat, Jerry, I know you couldn't be here.
Well, people kept saying we were looking to be.
You and I were down. Madam Chair, I have Colonel Almas with me from the National Guard here today. And what this bill members is trying to do is, I have a constituent of mine who met with me this summer, active duty. Everything seemed fine, but.
Bill number for members 2118, if everyone has it.
And it wasn't, and the young gentleman suicided, and she had asked me if I could do something, and I told her that I was invited to work Veterans Affairs and the hard in trying to do something that everyone could accept. I realized the sensitivity of this whole issue. I've tried to take the lead from Veterans Affairs and HARD, and we come up with a
let me first move the bill. That's our 21.
And if you could, then, Madam Chair, if I could just make two very small amendments to the bill. Line 1.6 after L. And on line 1.8, approximately, and then the bill is identical to the Senate file. And Senator Colonel said they can do this in their budget, but this will do. Members will then at the end of a year. Are becoming known that help our veterans.
Let me get the amendments. Amendment is saying on line 1.6 it's going to be health and wellness, and on line 1.8 we take out approximately and write between.
And that is correct.
Okay, and then we take out section 2.
I'll get the Lieutenant Colonel.
I'm sure members of the committee, Colonel, Military Affairs. We can conduct this training within our existing budget. What we would do is do it during our normal drill weekends. It's something that we're planning to do as we start the integration process in the 90 days. We recognize it as the beginning, not the end. So we always intended to do more to make sure we can help service members get all the way. As such, since that's conducted on drill weekends, there is not cost to service members, and we are going to be in there. If there is any cost with other agencies coming in, approach, we would be using our reintegration funds that were appropriated during the last biennium, and that would be used until the funds are exhausted. So, feasibly, sometime in the future, we would come and say, we need to look at some additional monies, but this would take us all through the biennium, making sure that we can deliver.
So, as I understand, we can delete section 2.
I'm sure that's correct.
Chair, Representative Rukavina, I'm trying to read the amendment, the one on 1.8, and it looks, maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it looks like you're trying to change it from meeting twice to meeting once. Is that the intention, or am I just reading it funny? Because it said there must be health assessments approximately 6 months and 1 year. And then now it says there must be health assessments between 6 months and 1 year. So is that the intention? I understand it correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Yes, Matt Lee is
then without an appropriation.
I had deferred, you know, in
6 months and 1 year,
but
spouses or
survey to check on their mental health. When they come in, we're going to do an educational assessment to find out if there's some educational benefits they can take care of. We're going to do a financial and workplace assessment to make sure that they're being employed. If they're not employed, can we get them a job? We're going to look at their financial condition and get them financial counseling if they need that. And then we want to look at their physical and mental health conditions, because some of the injuries, although they might appear to be mental health, when you're looking at traumatic brain injuries, it's actually a physical manifestation. The reason why we specifically, so I guess if you look at it, it could be worse. I think there's a number of assessments that so could be proper either way. It's one holistic assessment, but there's a number of smaller assessments. So if you made the change, there would be a plural issue with the setting. I don't know how that would work out. But as far as the two assessments, the concern that we had was that they get an assessment at the post-mobilization. They get one at 90 days afterwards, and then if we try to do one just a short time after that, and another one a year after that, it's sometimes you can over-assess people. Also, we get to see these service members every month, so we're looking them in the eye, checking with them. We have embedded healthcare providers in many of the locations where if we identify something, we send them over to them. So we want to make sure that we get a reasonable amount and that we're looking at them over time, but we don't over-assess it where it loses its value.
Madam Chair, if I might, why didn't you add the words "and wellness" also on line 8?
Madam Chair, remember, it was an oral amendment in the Senate version and didn't get added that. So that's the reason why.
Representative Holbrook will edit it. Well, Madam Chair, I'm still not sure it reads to reflect what they're actually trying to accomplish. And Representative Rukavina, if you're willing to trust that they're going to do this in the right period of time, you could actually probably just delete that sentence on line 8 that begins with "there" and say that they have to have a program of post-deployment health and wellness assessments, da-da-da-da-da, but if you want to specify...
Sure. To sit down and just see the pain in the eyes of the mother, and I promised her I was going to try to do something, and it was difficult to do because for a number of reasons, and I can't tell the United States Army what to do, or the United States Marine Corps party over the local guard, and you know, I hope our Veterans Affairs comes along, but I promised her I'd do something, because on the federal level, she really I can at least begin to do something here. Figure out that there are some types of assessments that may catch problems that people do. That's what I wanted to do.
Okay.
And if I admit, all this has been pretty straightforward with me always. I've been trying to get him to grow his hair a little longer, Don. But now I'm moving towards him, if you notice. I told my time this is all over, I'm going to have a ponytail. But other than that, I've worked very well with him, and I just kind of trust him. So I'm going to see if this works, and if we have to come back and change it, I know I'm not the only person in the room who's had constituents that have asked them for some help.
Well, Mayor, I'm just looking at the wording. What I'm going to figure out is if you want a health and wellness assessment offered between 6 and 12 months, or do you want it conducted? Are you mandating that this occur to every single one of the returned soldiers, or are you saying you want it offered? And are you going to do it multiple times between 6 and 12 months or once?
Well, right, Madam Chair, right now, from what I understand, there is a, when they come back, then there's a 30 and a 90.
Six and 90.
So, this will at least, at the very least, offer one more assessment. If I could do 6 months and a year, I probably would, but I don't know if there is money right now to do it.
Can I try something?
Sure can. You're the boss.
I think what Representative Hoberg has said is that she'd like to say there must be a health and wellness assessment between 6 months and 1 year.
Well, Madam Chair, I would also like to say I'm not sure I haven't heard from the author if he wants this assessment offered within that period of time or if he wants it conducted. If we're going to mandate for all soldiers to do this.
I want the soldiers to have the assessment.
So you want it mandated
to be conducted,
I think, or something.
And I think that.
Word,
but
and Madam Chair, to this point, Representative Rubina, I speak separately, I think, about the need for this bill. This is really, really important. And I really appreciate you bringing the bill forward. I want to make sure that the health and wellness assessment actually happens, as you do. And so my question, but to Colonel Allness, I think the question is, if not, the question isn't offered or conducted. I want to know who's on the hook for this. And is the National Guard willing to say the National Guard must offer or must ensure that a health and wellness assessment is offered or conducted? I just want to make sure that we're not using very passive language here, that we know that it's directive to follow.
We're going to strengthen the language.
And Madam Chair, remember, just to be sure that this is something that we intend to do, though, we intend to conduct this with the individuals to the greatest extent possible. And we also willingly offer the same training to other service members through our other training, whether they come off active duty in the reserve component. We've always looked at it as our responsibility as kind of lead military agency in the state to offer that to other branches and services. And we'll do that with our partners in the Department of Veterans Affairs. They're a willing partner with us on this.
Let me try one more chance at what I think Census has said. There must be a health and wellness assessment conducted between 6 months and 1 year after the end. Okay, we're also going to change the shall in line 1.6 to must. And we're going to, we delete section 2. Okay, does everyone understand that message? The first, and add wellness, okay, on line 1.6, other wellness. The Adjutant General must establish a program of post-deployment health and wellness assessment for members of the National Guard. That's it. Then there must be a health and wellness dealing with an agency or the National Guard that has done above and beyond the call of duty and initiated and been very progressive in this area. And so I just want to be certain that it's not like we're kind of coming on and really doing, I mean, they have already initiated this, have done a great job, have been an example to the rest of the nation in the work that they have already done, and then, as usual, their willing cooperation to take it up another notch in regards to doing this. But I think I was going to help with the language, but that's been taken care of. But nonetheless, it's a good bill, and it's nice also to see them being able to be fiscally prudent and to be able to take this and absorb it, and I will trust that you'll come back if that's not sufficient. All right. Okay.
One last thought, Madam Chair, and Colonel Allness, Representative Rubina. Some Vietnam veterans, constituents of mine, came forward with this concern as well. I actually know your constituent and the family, and have been involved in setting up a pilot program through the state that I've also done privately. So that's the PETS Peer Counseling Project. And I just want to make sure that we're all aware that that's one resource now that the department is rolling out through NAMI. I think we're about a week or two away from the first group. I'm going to have some information for members when we get back to share so that we can share with our constituents. But one of the points, as you know, Representative Covina, some of these veterans, especially combat veterans, need to talk to folks who've been through it to be able to really, for some of the issues that come up, that will come up through the health and wellness assessment, sometimes come out other ways. And I think that it would be nice to see more and more of that integration. I know, Colonel Allness, you've done a phenomenal job of making sure that all these grassroots efforts come together in a nice, comprehensive way. Really important. Thank you.
Okay. Any other? Thank you very much. And with no further objection, the bill will be laid over for consideration to be on our omnibus bill. Thank you very much. Okay, I think this is the last part of our schedule we really have to, an interpreter is needed in another place, so we need to go at this time. Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Commission of Deaf, Deafblind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. We have worked together, Office of Enterprise Technology and Admin, on looking at ways, there was previously a fiscal note that's all but disappeared over time, having it go totally away, and some of the language changes that we'll be working on over the next couple of days. We'll be working to achieve the highest level of accessibility for technology and web access while still not causing an undue burden to the state. I just also wanted to add, after the moving testimony that we just heard, that the disability with the highest level of prevalence for returning veterans is hearing loss. And in fact, the Veterans Affairs, National Veterans Affairs Commission has called it epidemic because it's increased with IEDs. So this would have an effect on the 10% of Minnesotans who are deaf, deafblind, hard of hearing, people who are blind, and people with other disabilities would have a significant impact on returning veterans.
Madam Chair and members, I'm John Molly from the Office of Enterprise Technology. As Representative Hilty said, we've been working, having some very productive meetings with Kent Allen from the administration and with Mary. We still have a few points to work out, some language that has some implications for us we'd like to see addressed, but I'm confident by the time that it comes to the next committee that we'll be able to work those out.
Don't get rid of them, the cost will be
too low. Not necessarily, Madam Chair. Again, depending on how we work out some of these things, it may go to other agencies rather than OED.
Somehow before.
I have great faith, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and members, I have two amendments. One is General members, this bill is a passion after Representative bill that you heard yesterday. It does the same provision on page 2, line 218, to strike the S in paragraphs to the B, the word and. That brings it into line with the bill in the entire. And then the other amendment, the A3 amendment, basically what that does is it includes the Metropolitan Council and the Airports Commission under the contracting authority for provisions of this bill. We, as we did the research on it, and we came to find that there were no restraints for those particular organizations under the way that originally written, so we wanted to be all inclusive in that provision. So that's what that group is.
I'm sorry.
Yes. Madam Chair. And members, this bill is much like Representative Newton's bill yesterday. We're talking about businesses having a preference, a separate group in terms of currently it's a targeted group of women, minorities, and disadvantaged businesses under 16C. It would increase or actually put into law a separate category that is for our veterans. Now, one of the issues that we're currently experience is these, particularly as these veterans go overseas and in the Guard, has here, they go over, a lot of these individuals have businesses, and they take the time often to their own detriment of their own businesses, and there are plenty of examples where they go over, they spend 3 to 6 months in training, they go over for a year, and then come back and they go on for another month and a half for reintegration, and they go back to the business, sometimes with the loss of contact, sometimes with the tremendous loss of revenue and influence in the community. This bill is tailored a little towards that to give some of the veteran-owned businesses and the disabled veteran-owned businesses, which Representative Newton's bill addresses, the ability to go to the state and to the governments that we've outlined here and say, you know what, we'd like some special consideration for contracts that are coming up before you. Currently, the women and the veteran-owned women and minorities and the disadvantaged businesses have a target of about 6% of the small businesses SBD provisions. Currently, they're using about 2 to 3% of that. Also, in terms of women-owned businesses, there's about 123,000 women-owned businesses and about 21,000 minority-owned businesses in the state. There are about 480 veteran-owned businesses and about 130 disabled veteran-owned. So those two together make up about 600 businesses against the 146,000 businesses that are in the other 10. I don't think that those 600 businesses would put a crimp in the remaining 3 to 4% of the contracts that are not being fully right now. This bill is meant to target those businesses, give them the consideration that many of them are going to need when they come back, also in terms of the sacrifices that they have made. Stepping up to the plate. And I might add that since we do have an all-volunteer force, that is a significant sacrifice that they're making with a new conscience. And I can keep going, members. You've heard most of the arguments from Representative Newton. The only thing that this does is it adds it to all veteran-owned businesses, a small group of about 480. There is no fiscal note on this because the Department of Veterans Services from the federal level makes the determination on these veteran-owned businesses. So, this is a real fiscal note. It would just be putting it into law, giving them a separate category that we currently do not have. I'll stand for any questions, Madam Chair.
Is it someone
this in the past was that there was no determination by the feds in terms of what was that disability process. March of this last year, in 2008, they stood up a portion of the federal government to make that determination. So now that is no longer required by the state, it's made by the feds.
The point is, I think the expansion to all veterans is another issue. I think that that's, you know, how the Department of Administration would consider that.
Here, but I at the federal level there. It's not just for disabled, but it is for veteran offenses as well.
I'm Dorothy Lovejoy with the Department of Administration. Madam Chair and members, to answer your question, the U.S. Veterans Affairs certifies the businesses, whether they're disabled owned or just that service disabled veteran or veteran owned business. So for purposes of administration managing that process, at the time of a bid award, if a business was claiming that preference, the purchasing agent would merely go to the vet business, excuse me, to verify the eligibility.
And is this, as I recall, the working with the disabled one fit into the same category that already exists in our federal contract? Does the veterans preference issue also exist on federal contract?
At the federal level, yes. They're approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I was just thinking, first of all, thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing it forward. I know that probably what means more to me is we just dealt with the other bill that had to do with returning veterans and their health assessment in that 6 months, 9 months. One of the things that affects them when they come back is that reentry, getting back into that job market, getting back into their business and getting it going again. And it can contribute to some of those other challenges, both physical and mental, that they deal with. This is a sort of tool that engages them in a very positive, productive process that can also help us stay in regards to maybe keeping them from dealing with some of the other depression and other issues that maybe now they're into a positive way and seeing us giving them a very practical business incentive to be self-supporting in regards to what they're doing. So I think this is a very constructive thing, whether you're a regular veteran or a disabled veteran, small pool, easily administered, I think, and I think this will also really help in that return and the discussion that we had in the previous bill. So I just support this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just asked Representative Stevenson to repeat again what the difference in numbers are between all veteran-owned businesses and just in the disabled veteran-owned businesses.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler. Yeah, the difference is about 480 current veteran-owned businesses and about 130 disabled. So one of the issues that we come in, we run into with the disabled veteran-owned businesses is that all military services are not the same. In fact, if you're in the Army or if you're in the Marine Corps, you tend to have a harder line for disability. And the Air Force, Navy, and Coast Guard tend to have a little easier presentation. So often when we've got some of these individuals who are coming back, they may not be playing on the same level playing field as disability or disadvantage. So another reason not to.
One of the things that Representative Stevenson discussed this earlier was that he said that it referred to recent veterans.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I was misspoken, and I was under veterans' preference. That's under another bill. That is not included on this one.
This is all veterans.
This is all veterans.
World War II, Korean War.
They're still working.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if the disability difference between the branches is because generally it's recognized and assumed that sailors are a little soft. wondering.
I'm kind of surprised at the numbers you gave. The numbers you gave are that small for veteran-owned businesses in the state?
I'm sure. That's correct. And I don't know if the Department of Administration has a chance of verification of those
numbers. And a similar bill was up before this body last year. And at that time, they had told us there were about 600 without distinguishing between service disabled and that would very much
And then there's no distinction in this bill between veterans and disabled veterans. Does the disabled veteran get any additional preference over non-disabled veterans?
And I'll let the Department of Administration, it would depend on if it was a federal contract, and that's our goal here, to be able to get at some of those federal contracts by creating the base here in Minnesota. But there would be a preference for the disabled, I believe, above the veteran-owned business.
Madam Chair, members, actually the provisions in 16C that is assigned to only does apply to state funded. It doesn't apply to any.
Question about the distinction between a veteran and a disabled veteran. Is there a distinction?
Madam Chair, members, the way this is written, there is no distinction.
Okay. We're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Something that's a little bit of this was originally brought to us by people working on the issue of disabled veterans.
And Madam Chair, I'd be open to create some language that could give a slight preference to disabled as well.
Okay, any other questions or comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 625 backs a little bit on what Representative Winkler would like to do, which is to have state websites to have a searchable database of state expenditures. What I'm proposing is something in addition to that, which would be an app for requiring the state finance system and app system to have an application program interface or API. You may have seen this written up a little bit in Politics in Minnesota about 10 days ago. In their weekly report, they were talking about the features of MMB's database the other day. They said, wow, an API, an application program interface added to on that would be great. So I called them up and I said, well, then you should be interested in House File 625. I think in your package you should also have a handout information from the Atlantic Monthly. Talk about some applications. The idea here is that you make, you just don't be able, you're just not searching on government expenditure data. You're also able to get that data exported so that any third party could develop some sort of application for a website, a blog, or even an iPhone or a BlackBerry, so that they can digest that information in some way that's useful for them or for anybody else. So the idea here is to free up some of this information and allow enterprising Minnesotans or anybody else to do something with this information. I would not be so prescriptive as to suggest what you would do with that data. The idea is to unleash a little bit of chaos with public data to allow people to think of that stuff on their own. We should not be the ones controlling how data is presented. That's it, Madam Chair, and I'd be happy to answer. And I noticed that fiscal note has zero on it, and folks at MMB told me that there may be some, I have certain things to make it consistent with what else they're doing, but otherwise. Representative Bigham, this actually has to do with the state expenditure data. And the council could develop the same application if they wanted to, or I should say make the data exportable, but it's not requiring how that's used. Certainly, like the MTC can allow you on the web to search out where you should be, what street corner you should be to catch a certain bus and so on. What somebody did in the Bay Area was actually develop an iPhone application, figure out all your connections that way. I'm thinking a little bit bigger, so if you wanted to analyze our rate of inflation affecting our tax expenditure, sales tax exemptions over time, you know, knock yourself out. You could. That's up for the people to decide what they want to do with it.
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, that's why I like to go. I think that it's important, especially because a couple of the other bills that we've done today are kind of all focused on accessibility for our information, and I think this is a good idea that I'm just glad you brought it forward, and we should continue to pursue other options for other areas of state government for us to have more accessible information and more information.
Madam Chair and Representative Bigham, if you want to call up Peter Bell and tell him to get with the program, that's fine with me.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Gardner. And this goes to Representative Winkler as well. You've got House File 20 coming up, and I'll just make a little speech once and I'll apply to both your bills. But I think you have to be really careful with what you prescribe. Has to be available. There is a lot of classification of data that extends beyond the Data Practices Act, number one. Number two, you talk about protecting the state security interest in the data. We also have business proprietary information that our statutes protect. And so I think probably a more blanket statement that the information would be available as provided by Minnesota law or something, because the classification of data falls all over the statute, not just in the Data Practices Act. And there would be proprietary business information that you may should be disclosed. You also may be find a situation where a contract would disclose a security feature or program or elements that really shouldn't be out in the public realm. So I think we need more work. Certainly we want transparency, but we also don't want unintended consequences of this or Representative Winkler's bill forcing disclosure of data that otherwise is classified private, confidential, non-public in other areas of the statute.
Representative Hoberg,
is the, I think all of those things, the privacy and all those things definitely have to be worded very, very well. But the unique thing is the application programming interface is usually outside of, and it just grabs data and it puts it into a user-friendly version, and it's a fairly straightforward way then of blocking whatever you've defined to be that. I think it's a very quick way. It usually works quite well. It enables folks out there who are great at doing quick programs to grab this data and do quick programs and do a lot of great stuff for it. So, but I think, you know, once you deal with those issues, it should be a good thing.
There is no manager. There is no Senate opinion. Senator Rest is up to her quota of 100 bills or something. The House could lead with this, and they would just say, "Oh, this sounds like a great idea." And come.
Okay, we couldn't care. That's not our primary consideration. Okay. So it says no further objection. Then this bill will be held over for possible inclusion in our omnibus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll look forward to hearing from you.
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Chair, I move House File 20 for this bill. It is very similar to, but not similar, but it's very similar in spirit, I guess, to Representative Gardner's bill, which is to create a usable, user-friendly, and easy-to-access place to get data on where government is spending money. And this idea is has a companion bill that's being authored by Representative Rest, but I guess it's just, I don't know if it's seniority or the other body or what, but I sent it over to her in December, and now it's become her bill. And this came from a conference that we attended out in Seattle in May, State CIOs for Governing Magazine or something, and I was talking with the CIO of the state of Missouri, and he was telling me about the Missouri Accountability Portal, which their governor just ordered by executive order for their IT department, VA. And having had a chance to go through and use it, I found it very easy to use, very easy to follow, way to identify individual dollars being spent on individual projects and individual agencies. We did recently see the administration's rollout of its portal. I don't know if that's limited by the map system we have in place or other technological limitations, but I personally didn't find that portal that was just rolled out very easy to use or useful for actually understanding their dollars. So the hope is that as we move forward with the new map system, they will be able to include in that design a portal that would actually be something more similar to what Missouri is. Representative Simon, the portal that the governor produced is in existence, but it's, I would say, awkward or difficult to actually access information or to use. It's this bill is drafted as best we can to identify more of the specific features and functionality Missouri portal has. So it's almost hard to describe the difference unless you actually try to use both, how much easier Missouri is to actually.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, as I understand it reading the bill, and I've seen this before, is the contract information is just that, it's the information about the contracts. You're not going to have the image
appropriation bills and, for instance, like the bonding bill, if there might be potential for the public to actually be able to follow and maybe even click through and see as we put together bills, actually see the proposals that I believe are fully public, but at least the images of projects, and that if there's some way that we can ultimately increase access and reduce some of the oversight of our process so that the public can track better where we're going with the work that we do.
And Chair Representative Kaelin, I mean, I think that certainly is a good idea, and there can be ways to do that. I don't know. I mean, the advantage here is that we have all the financial data and the program data in the MAP system, so it's more a matter of providing access in a way that's user-friendly. Look through pastor information for all the things that we're doing. The legislature would be a better question probably for the revisor and for Ms. Roberts and anybody, but it sounds like a fairly gargantuan task, given that it sometimes it's hard just to get words on paper kind of describing what we sort of want to do.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, I appreciate that caution a great deal. I wonder if we can't work it for next year, maybe a future bonding package, it might be interesting to actually let the public, you know, and work with the revisor's office to see if those projects that have put in proposals you can actually cut through, and we can ask them to select an image. You know, and it would be very interesting to see how that would further the public debate about the work that we do, and the interesting part of the project down the road. I'd like to see the result in House Bill 20, and then and reassess down the road.
I'm just fascinated by Winkler and Olberg and Chardon.
Yes. Sure. I never thought I would spend a bunch of time on a website.
I'm going on vacation too, and I won't be available for discussion.
And Madam Chair, you have some settings to represent a Winkler committee before it.
We'll show what that means. I have probably too arcane a question, but I noticed the repealer is section 15C on 046, and then when you look at the summary, it says it's maintaining a website and it's a redundancy. Why do we move it from 16C to 16A?
Madam Chair, I certainly didn't draft the bill.
Madam Chair, the reason it was drafted that way is because the current law was put in 16C because it only dealt with contracts. It only dealt with that chapter, which is still the contract. This is broader and it deals with all state statutes, so whatever law that governs the Commissioner of the Finance.
Further discussion? Thank you very much. The bill is now held over for
Thank you, Madam. Do you want me to?
Sure. Just wanted to ask my seven. And okay. We're going to get your question.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll start. Then I'll move that House File 7 be laid over for possible. Madam Chair, I'm looking for direction.
I think the recommendation is pass.
Okay, so Madam Chair, I recommend the House files. Move the House File 7 be recommended to pass and re-refer. And Madam Chair, I have an amendment which is in your, or we have an amendment as soon as we're which is the A35 amendment. Madam Chair, Mr. Shepard indicates that I don't know that I have the language for that, but work on that. I certainly would like to move that amendment as well. So House File 7 is a bill that was developed in working with Mr. Shepard and Mr. Nobles and others, including folks at the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, and grew out of some frustration that people who spending or wrongfully spending state funds were facing the consequences of termination from their employment. essentially created a gross misdemeanor for anybody who intentionally and knowingly spent money for a purpose other than that for which it was appropriated. Working with Mr. Nobles, we also added a section on best practices for investigations, which is section 4 of the bill. And there the concern is that when you have an agency conducting an investigation and they're compelling information from employees, they have, in order to preserve that information for evidence at a potential future trial, they have to issue a Garrity warning. And there's kind of a good way and less good ways of doing that. So the idea was to create a set of best practices for conducting these investigations so the evidence could be used at a future criminal trial if necessary. And that was, that's House File 7. The 835 amendment is the product of work that this committee has done on the whole issue of financial management and internal controls. And the amendment is, I would say, a joint amendment able to join us, but take my word for it that this amendment was both came up with, and the idea is to be very clear in statute what the internal control policies that the Department of Finance is required to establish. You may remember from previous discussions, there is general language in 16A of the statute about the obligation of the commissioner to maintain a system of internal audit. But it's fairly short. The 835 amendment actually provides a lot more detail based on the COSO standards that you again heard in testimony previously. This session are the kind of old standard for these internal control processes, and so it's to be very specific there. The bill also, or the amendment also, expands some of the requirements for the Legislative Audit Commission, and it creates a separate standalone financial controls council, which is appointed by the Executive Council of the state, and the goal there is to review the state's internal control policies and make recommendations, suggest guidelines, and to review the Commissioner of Finance with respect to these guidelines. Again, the intent is to try to model the independent board committee at Minsky and in other corporate settings that really takes a look at what the audit practice and internal control practices of the organization are. It stands alone from management, stands alone from the entire board, has some expertise in the matter, and is able to be an independent voice and in a place for independent evaluation of those practices. So that is the 835 amendment. Originally, my concept was to just do a separate and independent kind of Representative Downey thought it was important to make sure that the legislature was as fully active and involved as possible through the LAC, and so we combined those two together. Neither one of us, I think, has any particular might of authorship in this. It's the intent is to try to support a proposal that reflects some of the information findings that we as a committee have engaged in during this session.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume at some point we're going to discuss the fiscal note. So unless you'd like to wait, I've got a couple questions about that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler. In regard to this, and you have had a Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Winkler, I know that you and Representative Downey work together, and that you actually have two separate bills along the way here. So how does this amendment differ between those two bills? What's
stayed
between both of them? What's the same? What's different?
Madam Chair, Representative Tiffmeyer, what we basically did was combine two into one. And so Section 3 of this bill, the internal controls and internal auditing section, is either exactly the same or very similar between the two bills. And Representative Downey actually spent right level of detail. Section 4, the Financial Controls Council, then section 1 was in his bill, which is to expand some of the responsibilities of the Legislative Audit Commission.
So I apologize if this is redundant, but my interest was to make sure that there was a governance structure that provided the same kind of accountability that you would typically find for a private sector entity within the audit committee of their board. So while there's not a direct branches of government, the legislature in many ways, I felt, represented accountability, responsibility. We have a lot of that already with the legislative audit. What we didn't have was some kind of a mechanism with the legislature to see what was going on. A proactive internal audit perspective within the executive. So leveraging the Legislative Audit Commission, which already exists, already oversees the activities of the Office of Legislative Audit. The suggestion was that we to oversee and observe and provide feedback to the executive branch on the internal audit function. And when, so that was my component, representative some outside expertise in internal audit through this commission. And as we looked at it, all the pieces just fit together perfectly. So that same outside body of expertise is going to be available both the executive branch and the legislative commission. Advice from them on how we're doing here in
the interview. And Representative Kittmeyer, the part of the challenge is with separation of powers. I know that I think that the legislature is exactly the board of directors. Fits within one org chart. In many ways, the legislature is more like shareholders who. Or at least have a kind of a trying to figure out sort of how these people might be together. What other states look like. At least our best effort to try to say what was your best in ways of creating that kind of stuff.
Madam Chair. Yes, I appreciate that explanation. When I quickly read through the amendments, I find out both because I think they both had value. And both had an approach, and I knew you were working together to kind of try and end up with this. And so it sounds like you put it together, and of course, it's always something we as a body can come back and review next year. And but at least it gets us a huge part of the way, I think, in some of the things that we talked about. So I hope that indeed is the case, and you'll probably get more input and feedback as we go along here, making it better. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know. Legislative auditor is here. Do you have any
happens to you. We do present our audit findings to the audit committee of the Minsky Board of Trustees, and I think that gives our findings and concerns a bit more leverage within that organization. So I think the fact that we are working in an environment here with separation of power complicates things, but I compliment working out a structure that I think accommodates the role of the legislature, but also the structure within the executive branch. So I certainly can't speak on behalf of the Legislative Audit Commission itself. As far as my office is concerned, this is certainly a workable approach. I appreciate their consideration and concern. This committee's for the financial management of state governments.
I'm Madam Chair, members of the committee for the record, Ms. Kirk Yoakum of the Department of Finance. Of course, I don't have anything particular to say today. The underlying bill, HS7, was something that we've spoken in the policy committee and also, of course, the companion bill on the Senate side. As far as the new language today, we've seen pieces of it at least before, but it's not something I'm particularly familiar with at the moment. So just like to reserve the right to, of course, talk to the author and the committee as this goes forward, see if there's any insight. It's quite enough.
I've been spending a lot of commonality,
so which way the department has been wanting to go on this, and some of the conversations that happened. The State Government Finance Committee during the course of the session. Definitely there's a lot of commonalities which we'd like to go that I've seen in here, but I can't specifically say.
Any questions?
Anybody? Yeah, no, I just wanted to get, when I talk about this one for a second. Oh. Are we booking this? Are we not booking it? Or Representative Winkler, have you noticed that the Attorney General's office put a 2.0 pistol on that? Do you have an opinion on this?
Madam Chair, Representative Kleinman.
2.0 FTEs.
I'm sure that you have an opinion about it. I have an opinion, I guess. And what the pistol note basically says is that because of some small changes in 3.975 of the statute, which is in Section 1, specifically that the state official or employee has used money for a purpose other than for which the money was appropriated. In other words, it kind of clarifies the definition of misspent, and therefore, with a clearer definition of what constitutes misspending money, and the auditor then refers that case to the Attorney General, it might take two individuals to assess those potential claims and decide whether or not it warrants bringing suit in order to recover that money in civil court. I guess I'm skeptical that that would require two individuals to do, since it doesn't even expand really the scope of the kinds of referrals that the legislative audit commission or legislative auditor will send to the Attorney General. So, given that it doesn't change the scope, it just clarifies what the meaning is and makes other parts of the bill. I don't think that there would be any requirement or need to hire two more people to do that. So I guess I have some skepticism with the fiscal note.
I will with no further discussion.
I renew my motion that the House passed it as amended, be recommended to pass. And should it happen to be in the committee bill, of course, that'd be great.
Okay. Motion. Renews his motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, I'll move House File 1018 for consideration. Madam Chair,
Chair and members, House File 1018 is a fairly straightforward bill addressing an issue that I think we've probably heard hundreds if not thousands of times from our constituents about frustrations that we've experienced as well, and just reaching agency folks who can just finding somebody to talk to, finding a resource to answer a question. I know our professionals who work in state agencies do a lot of good work and want to make sure that the public can access our government. But also, 1018 merely requires that the homepage of a website maintained by a state agency have an email address and a telephone number answered by a human being during normal business hours be posted on the front page of that website, and just ask that state agencies do the common sense thing and comply with the requirement with in their existing resources. And Madam Chair, I'll remind the committee that when Commissioner Innes was before the committee, I think the week before I introduced the bill, I did ask them, because I think they'd received the highest volume of phone calls of any agency at Department of Revenue, and he expressed not only that he felt like it was a reasonable bill, but he actually expressed support for the bill, I believe. So they can handle it. I think that all state agencies can.
Does this still get passed on to finance, or shall go with the
flexible
inclusion?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure how much time is involved here, but I think that a dual track is probably appropriate for this bill. So,
Representative Kalin renews his motion that House File 1018 recommended to pass to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Chair members, Gary Goldsmith, I'm the Executive Director of the U.S. Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. To simplify things and to eliminate the fiscal note, the board would request the chair, who's the author of this bill, to amend the bill by deleting page 2, lines 1 through 8, in other words, 2.1 through 2.8. That deletes the board's request to authorize carry forward of funds from fiscal 9 and fiscal 10, and that carry forward word request was what generated the fiscal note, because the way the state accounting system works, that would have fiscal impact in FY10. We're no longer seeking to have those funds carried forward. We'll be able to deal with our budget without that. So the bill is a request that $50,000 in each fiscal year in an existing statutory appropriation be diverted from its statutory purpose to the board's operating budget. The statutory purpose is to provide additional money in addition to the checkoff on the tax forms to the general account of the state elections campaign fund, and that gets divided then equally between all representatives, get the same amount, senators get the same amount, and so on, based on the statutory formula. The governor's budget would result in the board being able to fund only 7 people. This additional funding will allow us to get to 8 people. We could actually use 8.5, but we're going to operate with 8. And this will allow us to do that not only for fiscal 10 and 11, but we do not anticipate asking for any increases in the next biennium either, in addition to this, because we will continue to improve our technology and be able to eliminate some data entry that's in our current proposed budget, and that will fund increases in salaries that might occur in contract negotiations. And so I will, I think, entertain questions. Oh, by the way, this was
for Chris Pesky. Opposed? Motion passed.
members, the effect of this bill would be in the 2010 elections about $200 for each representative in decreased public subsidy from the general account. And in the 2012 elections, a little bit more than that, and a similar amount to senators, of course. Board's recommendation in general terms to the legislature was that in looking at funding for the board's operations and for public subsidy and all of the components that relate to campaign funding, that those things be looked at as a group, and that rather than sacrifice only the board's operating budget, the committee and the legislature look at other sacrifices. So this would be a contribution from the candidates who run for office. Contribution to our budget. I'll entertain questions, and all questions about our budget were before this committee just last week. We, as I said, we prepared sort of a bare-bones budget, and in the interest of disclosure, which is part of our name, it's a really detailed budget. $600 for repairs. These are not in millions, but in actual dollars. There are a couple things in our budget that are sort of open, but we took guidance from the governor's office. For example, the governor directed state agencies to include a 2.27% increase in wages and benefits for 2010, 4.4% for 2011. So we built that in. Now, to the extent that the governor's office and the administration can negotiate state contracts, it would flow back down with surplus at the bottom and be returned to the general fund.
Are there any questions? Representative Dan.
Madam Chair, and first, Mr. Goldsmith, thank you.
I noticed there aren't a lot of co-workers. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to compliment your board and your own personal performance. Has been responded to very professionally at extreme speed, so I think you guys do a great job. My question is whether or not if we eliminated the public subsidy, if the staffing increases, would staff increase would still be required?
Chair Representative Downey, it depends on how you deal with public subsidy. There are a couple of proposals out right now to eliminate the contribution refund program. That component does not flow through our office or through our budget, and so if you look at our line items, you will not see that. It's about $11 to $12 million per biennium, and that is appropriated directly to the Department of Revenue, which then has a unit that processes the contribution refund forms and handles all the questions that fall under that. The only thing we do with that program is to certify to Revenue who has we also provide the forms, but because the cost of forms is so high, we produce them in very large volumes, and we have enough left to last probably forever. Software, the parties generate their own forms. So eliminating the contribution refund program would not save us any money. Eliminating the checkoff program, which provides both the party account payment and the general, most of the general account payment would save some money, but it's an administrative function that happens periodically in an election year, sort of wired in other year. So I think it would be sort of insignificant. Our role really is monitoring all aspects of campaign finance, and a lot of the money coming into campaign comes from public subsidy. But to the extent that it doesn't, it comes from contributions from the public. So and the bulk of our operation is simply money.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, House File 2131. This is the major recommendation from the Florida Outdoor Heritage Council. I do have a small amendment that we needed to do to be compliant with the rules. There's a provision in the bill relating to the open meeting law that was amended into 2132, House File, and needs to be taken out of this bill so that we're not having to go back to the rules. So the, I don't know if you want to have somebody move to 2131.
First of all, I'll move the 2131 bill. As it goes, finance. And you brought us the 374
amendment. 374 amendment, correct.
Explain the compliance with the outdoor.
If you look on page 11, this exception was drafted by Bill Becker from the DNR. This section was 2132 and not in 2131. And so when both bills were to make sure that we would take this out of here because 2132 is not here. So am I correct?
That's correct.
I'll move that. All those in favor of that say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Moving duplicative language from that.
So, do a quick walk through the bill.
Interested in the basic financing and how it goes along with general principles that we have of financing today, as opposed to the accelerated shallow lake restoration and enhancements.
I think an issue on page 6 and 7, an area of interest in is the Outdoor Heritage Conservation Partners grant program, dealing with the grants, and I do have materials just that they made back up for the Heart Outdoor Heritage Council was established in statute plan. Not part of the council would start on December 1st. So what you see in front of you that work. Council so what you see on pages 6 and 7 is that effort. There were several meetings of a subcommittee of the Outdoor Heritage Council. It was a council called the Grants Committee meeting. Are interested in those. Their recommendation is that $4 million 2010, go to agreement with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation here by competitive matching grants of up to $8 million. Page 8, you have more information related to the council. Then we have some more projects. And on page 10, we get into contract management. Team, it is $175,000. Fiscal year 2010, Commissioner of Management.
Thank you.
reimbursement, and reimbursement for the fund that's being used right now. Exception. Project requirements, criteria relating to seed, easements being permanent. Page 14, you have there's the process things, consideration to contract with the Minnesota Conservation Corps. The Outdoor Heritage Council may waive the application of paragraph A, clause 5. So, relating to donations, I believe. Payment conditions and capital equipment.
Purchase and recycling.
Bills accessibility. Have another. Relating to transfers of property. This required when they're declared. You have, I said, I have background information on the small grants. I have former Representative Darby Nelson who participated in the council. He's going to testify, and Mr. Becker has the administrative perspective as well.
Of giving this large amount of money to a private organization. Well, I don't think it's appropriate for private organizations to deal with private money, but not really to deal with public money. And the other thing I was really surprised at, looking at this, is the large amount of administrative expenses.
set is a 3-year figure. It'll manage them for 3 years. I believe the figures that you're citing.
We had looked over the A1 amendment, which in the Prairie language and the Prairie language, the council. I do have some members of the council here, not a majority of the council. Some members of the council are here. So the language on the Prairie looked over that, and that was fine. And then the interest in real property and the finance reports on the page 2.
Chair,
Central Region for the National Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Thank you. Welcome to the event.
Thank you.
The question that I've raised is why this figure for grants administration seems much higher than the corresponding figures that I've heard from either DNR or from the website of experience with my personal experiences with the LCMR, but not in the same with the LCCMR. You all seem to come up with a number of 2.5% as a maximum compared to the 6% that's in.
Madam Chair, I've been involved in grant making for approximately 25 years with several foundations, and I think this is a very reasonable figure. We'd be delighted to do that grant program for 2.5% per year, because these kind of grants will extend 3 to 4 years. So if we did it on an annual basis, it would be much more expensive. But we would be happy. You know, we're a nonprofit. We're not trying to make a substantial amount of money. If your concern is how we set our fees, we'd be happy to do it in a different manner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if Mr. Waggy was there. I guess I'm trying to understand what the differences in cost by having the DNR, the numbers the DNR provided, versus the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation.
As I understand it, I'm trying to someone
percentage
to me why I'm wrong. I'm looking at a percentage of 6% compared to a percentage of 2%. And I don't think when you're dealing with the percentage of a total sum of money, I don't think it matters whether it's over the amount that's spent each year or over the amount that's of the total amount. I'm sorry if I'm really being
Madam Chair, essentially what we're saying is that our cost for administering these grants, no matter how long they take, is $240,000. So if they take 1 year, if they take 5 years, our cost would be $240,000.
But as I understand it, from trying to look at the LCCMR numbers or the DNR numbers, their costs would be closer to
I take 2.5%. Madam Chair, I can't really speak to their costs, but I would be really surprised if their costs were as low as you said, and they didn't have any other way to subsidize their costs.
2.5% would be 100.
No. 2.5% of the total amount.
DNR can testify as to how much it's going to cost over 3 years to administer the grant as the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation has.
Sure.
The 240,000 figures, so maybe the DNR can say.
Chair, Dave Schatt, Fish and Wildlife Director for the Department of Natural Resources. We did provide a proposal to the LASAR Council for their review as they considered alternatives for this grants program, since we find a proposal based on $4 million appropriation. Our estimate for our administrative costs for that program would be $280,000. That's based on basically 3 FTEs, two full-time people in the system to oversee this program. I can't speak to the historical costs that you're referencing. I don't know.
Coming from DNR, that historically the grants have been done to 2.5%, and somehow this one is up to beyond 4%. And what
of lines 1.12 to 1.21. We agree that there's no
proposing to
year. This was $840,000. That was my understanding. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think you heard two figures from the DNR. I think the comparable figure for the DNR's grant that was put forward at the same time as this one was $280,000 compared to $240,000.
$280,000 per year versus $240,000 for 3 years.
Talking about the total. Please, can you clarify this?
Madam Chair, one of the difficulties of establishing any fee for this program is that nobody knows how many applications they're going to receive or how many grants they're going to make. So everybody has to make an estimate. I think our estimate was very reasonable, but if we ended up making, let's say, 100 grants or something like that, of 40,000, I don't know math very well. But at any rate, if we make a whole lot of small grants, we're going to lose our shirt. Okay? I mean, these are all estimates. I think we've done a really good job of making a very low estimate. And we're going to live with that. But they're all very difficult decisions. But if I may, could I make a little statement about the precedent value of it? Because when you initially started out, you expressed some concern about the precedent. And I want to say that, you know, although we're not a really well-known organization, we've been around for 25 years, we were created by Congress, we have not only annual audits like most other nonprofits, but all of our records have to be turned over to Congress every year. Our board of directors is not self-perpetuating, but it is named by the Secretary of Interior and the Secretary of Commerce. So we're a very secure organization. But in terms of the precedent value of working with us, I really hope that the state of Minnesota works with us to find out that we can do a really good job. And the reason is that I think that this is the kind of entity that would be really useful for the state of Minnesota. Approximately 20 states have state foundations like our own that work to support their DNRs or their Bowsers or whatever they have. And I think that these things are really a good thing. If one was in existence now, you wouldn't be talking to me. So I hope that in 2 or 3 years you'll invite me back and ask me how you can establish one of these for the state of Minnesota. And in terms of precedent value also, right now, our foundation is administering grant programs for 11 different states. You know, this may be unusual for Minnesota, but it's not an unusual thing for the nation as a whole.
Just one question. Are the state foundations you refer to using state funds or private funds?
You mean the 20 state foundations I was talking about? Yes, they are usually having a combination of state and private funds. But the great programs that I mentioned that we are administering right now, those are state funds. I supply every member of the committee with a list of the programs that we're working on right now with state or municipalities, and those are state funds.
Madam Chair, perhaps I'm just going to ask Representative Hansen to answer this question then, so that we can, on an apples to apples, year to year, let's just take it 1 year to 1 year. Is my assertion correct or is Representative Pepin correct? I don't care about the ego, I just want to know that someone's right and that one number can be relied on that we can all work from. And that is the $240,000 a year to administer this
sources. I think you hit on the problem. Or apples to apples here. We did take a different approach in providing these proposals to the council. When the department put the proposal forth, we just looked at what it would cost to administer a $4 million annual grant program, and we said we'd have to staff up with these three people. So we assume that this would be an ongoing program. We get $4 million this year, $4 million the next, $4 million the next, and we would oversee that program, that ongoing program with those three people, and that would amount to $280,000 per year. Appears looked at just the cost to administer a single $4 million grant and paid for the included costing those tails in the subsequent years in their administrative costs. So it's just a different way of approaching the budgeting. Yes. So I'll leave it at that, I guess.
Madam Chair, I think that what
We also heard from Denise Anderson, who gave us why don't you come back and tell us what you said again? Gave us exactly the state was your. Denise Anderson, for the record.
What I stated was that we received for the ELSIs in our grant program.
Has there been any problems administering the LCTMR program on that 2.5%?
It does not fully cover our costs. That's some other.
And is there an estimate of the additional amount for LCTMR on that program? Yes.
Director Shag testified earlier, we did together our assessment would be.
Madam Chair, did that $280,000 cost estimate include the collaboration and kind of what's the interplay between the LCCMR grant and this grant program? I'm sorry if it was asked already, but if there's some non-LCCMR funds that are helping support the LCCMR grant program, won't some of the same staff and collaboration happen? I'm thinking of Wayne Sands and the other folks that do incredible work there. Can't we get more value added that way? Does that make sense? I mean, I appreciate I wasn't totally clued in on why you were bringing this point originally, but more and more it's becoming clear, and I think the council is starting to understand too. Some of the when you've had a very great opportunity to start from zero, and so you're able to sort of isolate the project, but then as the projects continue, you start to get this issue of things don't end at the end of the fiscal year, that they roll over, and that's a lot of our challenges we budget is this tails. And I do have some caution about the precedent setting of using an outside organization to contract where there's not that value added that happens from both institutional knowledge, but then also I think incurred an assumption about you're assuming that the council's going to make a recommendation and we're going to appropriate another $4 million, another $4 million. Whereas I think it may be wise to look at the institutional memory and the relationships with other appropriation and LCCMR questions to look at the DNR as the better place for this first round and then to get a better sense of where things are from there. I struggle with that because I really respect the work the council has done, but I think that there is a state government finance question that goes beyond Representative Rodinius's budget that I think you're getting, and I appreciate you now that you have brought this forward.
know, when we've given money from LCCMR to the DNR, they've managed to do it on 2.5%. So the answer is when we give it, again, I haven't been there for a while, but what's the kind of the level of money that Wayne Sames does is probably significantly less than how much has the last one. The last one was. Well, what kind of numbers are we looking at? What are the kind of numbers? You know, one of the things in terms of the years of dealing and watching people deal with Wayne Sames is that I've never heard of particles complaint. Don't get grants from him. I, again, never say that they didn't get it because of some inappropriate assumptions or anything like that. So.
Sure, I think that Eddie.
I understand your point of the person and whatnot, but I'm trying to
understand why this is even an issue. It's what they chose. They've done their work. We put them into place. And from the numbers, I can see there's a considerable savings by going with this National Digital Allies Foundation. So I'm having a hard time understanding why we want to step over Mr. Becker and the Outdoor Heritage Council.
Let me just speak to the part of micromanaging.
I will reiterate my concern about